and welcome to a new episode of LedgerCast. I'm here in person with Derek Walchek. Hey, Derek.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. So today we're going to do a kind of multifaceted episode that I think we'll be able to tie together. I want to talk about your experience at Consensus. Mm-hmm. You did three interviews that by the time this comes out, all three will have been published. And I just want to get your take on what you saw there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to tie that in to some of the narratives that I've been seeing lately around blockchain platforms, Ethereum and EOS and all the stuff that's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get started just by talking about what was it like at Consensus with the state of the market? Because there was an inverse correlation, it seemed, between Consensus excitement and price action.
Yeah, you know, early on, I think there was a dump before, and then a few announcements came out, and the market started to go back up during Consensus. And then towards the end of Consensus is when it really dumped off.
Were people really paying attention to the price? Or?
I mean, I think I was. it's hard to say. I think, you know, depends on who you are. If you're an investor, certainly you're paying attention to price. If you're pitching an ICO, it doesn't really matter because you're there to raise equity. And if you're one of the tech people, if you're one of the tech people, you don't really like Consensus because of all the suits, of which I was one. and, you know, just all the ICO shysters that were trying to raise money. And, you know, you really just kind of wanted to find your corner where you could talk about tech and, you know.
Did it feel like an overwhelming number of people there?
It really did. It felt way overwhelming. The facility, it was at the Midtown Hilton, which is a pretty big hotel. I think it was the largest convention that they'd ever held at this facility. So you had like three levels below the hotel tower, and then you had the lobby. And so, I got there on Sunday, and I got there pretty early to get in line to get my badge, and it took an hour. Like the line, like literally circled, and then it kind of curved in on itself. Like
yeah, it looked ridiculous.
It was terrible. It was like people were like trying to find the end of the line, you know, and then they were like, my goodness, there is just horror.
What about in terms of the average person that you were talking to? Like, were they just pitching whatever they've got and you have no idea who they are? Was that constant, or was it people legitimately interested trying to learn about the ecosystem and that kind of thing?
It's hard to say. I mean, it literally was just a sea of people, and it was just thick and it was hot.
You couldn't really differentiate.
Yeah, and so not only did you have the convention going on the bottom two or three floors, but then you also had the hotel lobby, which is where a lot of people hung out who didn't want to pay the $2,500 for the conference. And so the lobby was also just as thick with people. And so people meeting and doing things, and actually paid a little extra and got access to the executive lounge, mm-hmm. which was perfect. I mean, if you ever do a big convention like that and you want to get some work done, I think I paid $35 a night, got the executive lounge, fed me breakfast and dinner. And then it was kind of a way to get away from people.
Nice.
And then in the executive lounge, there were like some important folks doing some, you know, important things.
That's a nice little free tip for everybody.
Oh, it was great.
$35 a night.
Yeah, like BitFury. Yeah, like
being out in the mayhem for like, $3,000.
Yeah, like the folks from BitFury, they just kind of hung out in there. And there was like the back table they basically reserved for 2 days. And
you don't even have to be part of the conference to do that?
No.
That
was just the hotel. And then the Wanchain folks, like Dustin Byton, was there. He was there a lot, meeting with folks. So
you could have not gotten a ticket and gotten the lounge and just had quieter, more comfortable conversations for
$150. I mean, if you're just scheduling meetings and you don't want to go to any of the talks, that's the way to do it. A lot of the really smart people, that's what they did.
Yeah, that's funny.
Plus, you have to remember it was blockchain week in New York.
Yeah,
which meant that there was competing conventions going on during
Consensus. There was Fluidity, and then all the ones during Consensus. I don't even know what they were.
That's right. And there was, you know, at night there was probably a choice of 10 different meetups or parties that you could go to if you had known about them and registered in time. I went to the Yeah, I went to the MetaCert party, which was really great. It was at the Gramercy Park Hotel, and they did it really, really right. And you know, it's funny, you can just get a sense of teams, what they're about, and the people that they attract. I'm really excited about MetaCert and what they're doing. I think. Cool.
And we did an interview with Paul.
Mm-hmm.
I assume Paul was there.
He was. Yeah.
Did you think that from a technology perspective, people were talking about products that are either ready or close to ready? Or is it like, well, a couple of years from now, we have plans for this or that?
It's still, you know, it's a mix. I wrote this in my little Medium post, but...
Which was funny, by the way.
Thank you. Good. I appreciate that. So the Medium post, I talked about how there was like a conference within a conference and how the folks from Lightning Network and Blockstream, they basically, within the convention, they had a room and they had their own conference going, basically, with, you know, on the hour, there was a different talks or workshops and things like that. And so if you're a tech guy, that was probably your favorite place to be.
Yeah.
They had good swag, too. My kids appreciated the fun
Did
handouts.
Did you come back with a backpack full of stuff?
I came, literally, I think I really wanted to get good t-shirts because, you know, tech shows have great t-shirts.
Yeah.
And so I think I ended up with probably 16 or 17 shirts.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I had to, in my hotel room, just like cull 6 or 7 that, you know, for whatever reason I didn't love, and just left them in the hotel because the weight in my bag was too high.
My wife has a one-in-one-out rule for me now because I've got 2 drawers full of random tech t-shirts from the web space. So if I came home with 15, there would be a disaster in my one-in-one-out rule. So
yeah,
that's cool. So what about in terms of platform competitiveness? Because I want to dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the story of this year, I think, is, you know, EOS is going to launch in June. Zilliqa is trying to launch in September. That's their goal. They've said that's aggressive. Whether they hit that or not, I don't know. So I think, and you have other platforms that'll launch this year. So this year's going to be, I think it's going to be the story of that is, you know, what kind of network effects can they create? Does it work? Does the tech work? You know, we're going to talk about this, but does ETH just get too big and, you know, they don't implement their stuff in time and they start to lose some of their community, which, by the way, their community is so much bigger by orders of magnitude than anybody else.
Yeah.
And that, you know, beyond the data on the throughput, I mean, that's just as big for blockchain.
Do you think, so EOS is approaching this whole thing with the $1 billion fund of essentially paying or giving people venture capital style funding in order to choose EOS.
Basically, they're paying to build their network.
Did you see excitement around that idea while you were there? Or did you see people that were talking about taking or participating in that?
Yeah, I didn't see anybody who particularly was doing that. But I think some of the people who I would say that I met with that I consider the smart people in the field, they're all excited about EOS.
What about in terms of people that are running on Ethereum? Do you think some of those projects, can they survive if Ethereum doesn't win? Because one of the things I've been thinking through is right now, 90% plus probably of all the projects we're seeing, all these ICOs and everything, the ideas that they've got, they're all based on running on Ethereum.
Mm-hmm.
And if Ethereum dies, does that mean becomes less relevant if something like EOS does take the main stage in terms of the platform you want to be on? What happens to all those platforms?
Well, I would back up a little bit and say, okay, so if this is Web 3.0, right? If this is the future and most everything is eventually going to run through this, then not one platform is going to win. You're going to have multitude of platforms that are going to do certain things. You know, with Ethereum, it's decentralized, right? EOS is more centralized, as we talked about. You know, being centralized to some people doesn't matter at all. They just need a blockchain that works, and they don't care. And they need the high throughput.
Yet in their taglines, almost all of these talk about the importance of being decentralized, right?
Well, that's because they're supposed to. That's what the field's about, supposedly. But, you know, so you're going to have these, and Kyle Samani at Multicoin Capital talks about this. You know, they're backing pretty much any platform. What they say is, you know, a blockchain is just a series of choices that you make on how decentralized are you, how fast is it going to be, what are other trade-offs? Because, you know, you pick one, you lose another. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a blockchain that has a certain set of values, if that meets the market for whoever they're trying to meet, then that blockchain is going to work. Because that accomplishes the goal of what the dApps want that to be run on top of.
I think another one of the things in that... balance equation, mm-hmm, is going to be governance and how centrally governed are you versus decentrally governed versus basically non-governed. So you have signaling basically from
right.
participants in the network, which that is governed, but it's not near the design that you see in, you know, a lot of projects.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a big part of why someone would choose to use one platform or another, like having a stake in the future of it?
Like probably. I think we are going to see why governance is so important over the next couple of years. I think you're going to see problems with, you know, a completely decentralized organization.
That could be like some massive crisis that comes up.
Right.
Like the DAO.
Right.
Like that. That was obviously the type of crisis that shows you need governance to take care of a situation like this, right?
Or you need, again, it is a value set of questions. You know, you may value the fact that you had a leader that was strong enough that could say, we're going to unwind this. Because at the stage of that ETH was, it didn't need to do that and go off in that direction. It needed to undo that. I'm not arguing for that, but I think there are people who would argue for that, and therefore their choice is going to be Ethereum.
Mm-hmm.
Or another blockchain that's a little bit more centralized.
Yeah. No, that makes sense to me. I've been, in my mind, I keep using this framework of similar to browser wars, you know, and like,
okay.
So Netscape, we right. don't see anymore, but Netscape was dominant in the early web.
What did Netscape do wrong? Or what did it not?
I can't remember exactly, but a lot of the early browser wars thing that what settled them was around how they handled standards and stuff, and how they managed web standards, in terms of like viewing websites the same and whatnot. I can't exactly remember what killed Netscape though, but obviously part of it was just not being the better browser,
right?
Even though it had UI. Market dominance. And the same thing for say Internet Explorer. Like even though Internet Explorer ships with every Windows computer, Chrome overtook Windows Explorer. Right. Mozilla had a run and still exists. And I do think the resolution might be like that, where you know you could have things like what Mozilla is for browsers, where it's a perfectly functional and decent browser, but it's never probably going to be a majority market share browser today, because you know Chrome kind of rules that world, and IE has made a resurgence as they've become more modern. And I can see this parallel blockchain land. It makes sense to me, but it still seems like there's got to be some sort of resolution to where one becomes dominant. And right now that's Ethereum, but that's very much in question in terms of will that continue to be. And there's a couple of specific things I want to bring up.
Yeah, one thing before we go down that road, I think you were in an earlier question asking about what apps are saying about Ethereum that are being, you know, that are being started on Ethereum. I do think there has been a little bit of a change in, if you ask, you know, an app or, you know, a program, what are they going to do? You know, when you ask the question, what if Ethereum doesn't scale?
Yeah.
You know, I think 9 months ago, the answer was, oh, we feel confident in Ethereum's ability to scale. We don't have any doubt. We're good. I think everybody now kind of has a plan B, or says that, you know, we'll look at it, we'll figure it out, and if we need to be, we can port to another blockchain.
And actually, even when I think about the you know, they say there's a platform, mentioned Zilliqa, and the big thing is sharding. Well, Ethereum says, well, we're going to have sharding, and bring up Tezos, and it's going to be governance, and well, we're going to have governance, and you bring up off-chain solutions, and you've got, they're saying, oh, well, we've got Plasma or whatever that's going to handle some of these things. But none of that, we haven't seen any of that ship yet. But there seems to be a lot of developer excitement around working on those things. So I guess that plays into that plan B concept.
Mm-hmm.
But the proof is going to be in the pudding for Ethereum. So there's a couple of things recently that I've seen that came up that were, maybe they're FUD, maybe they're worth talking about. One was how Ethereum has to be centralized because the blockchain is going to be so big, because everything right now is going on chain, all that data and these smart contracts and everything else is there, and the blockchain itself is growing exponentially.
Yeah, so I saw something that was talking about how that the Ethereum, the data now is above 1 terabyte.
Yeah.
What is the significance of that?
So my understanding is that it makes it much harder to run like a full node. And therefore, you're saying the only people that can secure this network through running the nodes is our supercomputers. And if you have larger and larger blockchains that need to be synced, then, you know, it's not like you can have it on your home computer and you'll have tens of thousands of people securing that network.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up centralized anyway. And you're also not getting the increases in performance when you design it from the get-go to have fewer people validating and being full nodes on the network. When you compare to like delegated proof of stake with EOS, like they know that it's delegated. So like they have fewer full nodes mm-hmm. securing the network, but now there's fewer people that need to firm and check everything. So it's more centralized, but it's more scalable because they've made that sacrifice in that balancing act that you talked about that I think you said Kyle brings up.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a tweet that brought that up, and that's why I was just wondering about it. And it seems like, according to this person at least, that they some of the more prominent people in the space too are trying to balance these questions. And I don't really know. Like I'm just raising questions. Well, I'm not trying to have some authoritative stance on it. I just see, you know, like your take on consensus, where you have all these projects, and what we're seeing in the new project landscape. There's so many Ethereum things launching, and it's like we don't even know if Ethereum itself is going to be right.
Yeah, but I just think that's also because that's the easiest way to raise money. You know, you launch a token, you raise it with the common currency, which is Ethereum. It's just easy. You know,
but most of their projects theoretically will require Ethereum as well, unless they're just raising money and they don't have any need for Ethereum beyond that.
Right. Well, some of them are, you know, like Open Network.
Yeah.
Open Platform, which we're both invested in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're raising the Ethereum token. You know, their open token they raised, and there's going to be a swap because they're going to do their own blockchain.
Yeah,
but it's just easiest to raise.
So it's used for the ICO, and this brings us to the second piece of Ethereum FUD that I wanted to talk about today, which is the highly ridiculous Twitter handle of Buttcoin. but they brought up the point that it's been 3 years since Ethereum was released, 10 billion raised, and so they checked the top 10 DApps. Centralized applications that have been built with Ethereum, and it's like a few exchanges for swapping Ethereum tokens, and then basically these random games and Ponzi schemes. And really, out of these, something like CryptoKitties is basically the only one that's a standalone thing, but it's CryptoKitties. And when people talk about, like, even when like Vitalik has talked about dApps, like, he ends up talking about CryptoKitties, and maybe it's a huge deal. There was a whole event at Fluidity where they were talking about digital art, and my friends at the Coin Talk show did an episode about digital art on the blockchain and how that could be a big deal. Maybe it will be a big deal, but like, if digital art on the blockchain and rare CryptoKitties, whatever, however you want to put that, if that's the only thing they've got, like, that's, to me, a little nerve-wracking.
Mm-hmm.
If those are the only applications they've got, and then... that's supposed to be the whole promise of Ethereum, but it's also supposed to be the whole promise of all these other ones. So now you count, if you bring in like what EOS has got and Zilliqa and all these other ones, and they're like, well, no, we're the better. It's like they're acting like there's this massive demand to build dApps, except for where are the dApps?
Yeah, I mean, this is still, we're still in an experiment.
No, I know it's nascent, but it... It, to a degree, it just makes me bearish on the whole concept, because it's like there's this tool building without the need for the tools.
All right, so I'll put on my black hat and I'll be Jimmy Song.
Okay.
In the room. Okay, which to me that was sort of the most drama of the conference was.
Yeah. So can you give us a summary of what happened there?
What was the name of the guy who founded Ethereum with Vitalik? It's in that article. Is it Paul Root? Tubin?
Joe Lubin.
Okay. So it was really fun. I'm friends with Jimmy. And it made me cringe a little bit because you had, oh shoot, what's her name? She was moderating the panel. The lady who just left, JP Morgan.
I know who you're talking about.
She started her own. We'll edit her name in somehow. We'll flash it on the screen.
She's been making funny photo shoots all over the place because she relaunched the thing too.
Yeah. So we're at the conference, and this was one of the big announcements. Is what is this lady who was formerly at JP Morgan, who was in charge of blockchain for them? What is she going to launch? You know, because there's big drama around this. And so basically she unveils this thing. It's called Clover.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Clover. And what it is it was the way to let a user pick and choose different platforms and different programs to kind of design their own blockchain solution. And so that's
Amber Baudet.
Amber. So that was her announcement. Okay. And then it went straight from there, where she was on stage with her tech guy, and then she sat down, and then she's moderating the Joe and the Jimmy conversation. And so she just threw a softball question to Jimmy and said, hey, what do you think? No, I'm sorry. Went to Joe first. Joe's like, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm impressed. And, you know, happy you're not raising another coin. If you could make this work, that's a good idea. And goes to Jimmy, and Jimmy's like, I don't know. This looked like buzzword bingos to me. And I'm like, are you really going to be that rude, you know, to her? And he's like, and then he just kind of goes on a tear where he's like, look, he's like, this whole convention, it's buzzword bingo. You throw a blockchain word, you raise a bunch of money, but you don't even need to use a blockchain for the things you're working on. And his argument was, you know, a blockchain is needed for Bitcoin. The blockchain is what allows you to trade Bitcoin. But when you use a blockchain with all the problems that it has, for anything else, you're using a product that basically costs you so much more than if you just use a centralized database. And he's like, this whole thing is built on a house of cards.
Well, he's not wrong that it's cheaper on a centralized database, right?
That's right.
I mean, so the idea is, how strong is the demand for a decentralized version of some of these things?
Right. And so I think he would argue that unless it's a true digital asset that is only a digital asset, you don't need to use a blockchain. Like, money is a digital, or Bitcoin is a digital asset. There is no physical form. And he would say that, for instance, like the field I'm in real estate, and we're all excited about tokenizing real estate and what that would give you. And he's like, yeah, but really you're just replacing an ownership structure. Like, if you bought real estate with me, you'd own a part of an LLC, which would own the real estate. And he's like, well, if you tokenize it, you're really just owning a token that owns the LLC that owns the real estate. You're not really changing the fundamental aspect of that. And if the dream is that you can tokenize the actual square inch of dirt that you own, and that's on a blockchain, and that's, you know, immutable, well, there's still going to be some authority figure, whatever municipality you're in, is going to say, no, you own that or you don't own that. I don't care what the blockchain says. So unless you remove government, which you're not going to do, then this dream that people have is never going to really happen.
Maybe in terms of how decentralized it is, in terms, or how immutable it is, but maybe not in terms of just it being a better system, right?
Yeah, but he would probably say, okay, well, it's a database you're trying to create. Why does it need to be decentralized? And, you know, and so he's written a post, we should post this also, of how his idea is it's better than using a blockchain. You just use some of the aspects. You might use a cryptographic signed key. That might be the thing that you want to add to whatever you're doing just to make it a little bit better.
So they made a bet on stage?
They made a bet, yeah.
I'm reading this article.
So basically, Jimmy was like, I would bet you in 5 years.
Yeah, he said within 5 years.
But
I don't know what the bet was.
Oh, it was within 5 years, you won't have five applications that are widely used on the Ethereum blockchain. And Joe's like, I'll bet you any amount of money or any amount of crypto. Meaningful adoption of just five applications won't have meaningful adoption in 5 years. So Joe was like, you're crazy. Bet you whatever. And so then they left there where they needed to define the terms. What does meaningful?
Do we want to do an over under? How many Bitcoin are at stake? Or Ethereum?
That's a good question.
I bet Jimmy would bet a lot more Ethereum than Bitcoin.
Yeah.
If he's bit bearish on blockchain. That's a good point.
Although I don't think Jimmy owns any Ethereum. Okay. I think he owns Bitcoin and he owns some Decred because he's an advisor on that project.
Yeah. So what's our over under on number of Bitcoin on this bet?
100? I don't know.
I'd take a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
What's that? $1 million almost?
Yeah.
At one point, $2 million.
Yeah.
By then, could be a lot more.
Or a lot less.
I'm going to take the under on that because I think even people with that much Bitcoin, 100 Bitcoin, they probably value because they are, especially him, a Bitcoin maximalist.
True. Although he's super confident in what he thinks.
I think I'd put the number more around like 10 to 20 Bitcoin.
Okay.
But I don't know. I don't have no idea what they're actually worth. But it's hard for me to imagine 100 Bitcoin on a single bet.
I think the real question is, will the bet actually happen?
Yeah.
Will they be able to define terms enough where they're both happy?
I think we need to ask them if this bet is the real deal.
Yeah.
Or if it was just stage talk, which would disappoint me greatly.
I don't think it was stage talk.
I want terms. I want terms on this bet, and I want it to happen.
Yeah. So then you had this, you know, pretty big kind of... I mean, the crowd was...
On stage conflict.
Yeah, and the crowd didn't know what to do. You know, they were laughing. They were kind of clapping.
Well, they're victims of Jimmy's prediction, if it comes true.
Well, I will say, though, if you polled the audience based on the applause, there were many more people applauding Jimmy.
I guess that's where your observers were. All the people pitching were out at the booths and stuff.
That's a good point. So then, you know, then after you hear this, it plants a little seed of doubt in your mind, in my mind, like, okay... And you kind of see, you walk back through the exhibitor space and you look at all the projects and you kind of have a little bit more jaundiced view, which I think was healthy to have.
Yeah, I think having a skeptic's hat on is probably the right mental positioning.
Totally. But it's hard to maintain in that bubble.
Yeah, it's so easy to just be super bullish on everything.
Oh, yeah.
Even to the point where, and I do want to dig into a little bit about what we've seen pricing-wise since then. And everybody's expecting this consensus pump, which was basically a false narrative from the get-go.
I don't know. I think it's the... I think people knew that the enforcement action was coming. Because the buzz that you heard from, like, Thomas Lee, the guy who's always on CNBC, like, when you saw his post... CNBC interview on consensus. You know, he came on and was like, I was wrong, didn't happen. But he was somewhat melancholy. He said he was melancholy. And his comment was that the enforcement action, basically that you're not going to get clearer regulation as quick as he kind of thought you were. So something happened with regulations at some point in the conference, or that was sort of the buzz.
Well, what we've seen since then is SHIP was a project that the South Carolina AG, I think, gave a cease and desist for, and they've already responded to that. What's funny is, I mean, I saw people buying it, on the dump. So
they're not the team's not running. You know, they're not just kind of running away. I mean, they're going to fight it. So
that could be one of many court cases that actually helps kind of define these rules and puts challenges on the Howey test and whatnot. Personally, the one big thing that I noticed was this hype for the security token landscape.
Oh yeah.
So, I mean, I've mentioned on the podcast that I owned, and I still own Poly, or Polymath, and they were a speaker and all that. And like normal, dumped the news, so it dumped pretty soon after they got on stage. But just there was a lot of hype around security tokens in general. So it seems more people are coming to this conclusion. Just call a spade from a lot of these, and they are securities, limit who can trade them and do things with them, at least in the United States. We're not seeing that at all throughout the rest of the world. A lot of the rest of the world, like, they're not really trying to hide the fact that they're security tokens. They're essentially directly valuing the company or the token with the network and like it's a security, not even trying to do a utility-focused narrative or whatever. But... at least in the U.S. and maybe a little bit in Europe, there's definitely this security token push. Did you feel that while you were there and talking about it?
Yes. And I'll say this: I'm surprised because that is the buzz that 2018 is going to be about the year of the it's going to be the year of the security token. You have Poly, you have Harbor, and then you have Templum and T0. Et cetera. But it's interesting. There still isn't great places to invest. I mean, that's like there may be four or five places that you could buy something to participate in that at this point.
Yeah, I know Polymath. Harbor doesn't have a token, is that
Harbor
right?
does not have a token. They, then, they've said, yeah, they, I had a really interesting conversation at their booth. They, you know, their argument is that we don't need really a token. Token yeah. is really necessary for what we're doing. And so what they're going to do is they're going to start with real estate. And so this summer, they have a batch of properties around the United States with sponsors who either own the real estate or are going to buy the real estate. And they're going to tokenize some highly known real estate around the United States. So I don't know what it's going to be. You know, it's not going to be the Empire State Building. That's but think yeah. like buildings that you might know.
Something you might recognize.
Right. And so
or then, a baseball stadium or something like
yeah.
something big.
And so what this will be is you can own a slice, let's just call it the Empire State Building, just to make it simple. You can own some tokens that own the Empire State Building. You get distributions from the building itself. But then what's different about this is you have immediate liquidity the day after you buy.
This is the type of thing you would love for your business, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. Because so if you can own a building that you know and you get cash flow from it, and if you need to sell it tomorrow, you can do that because there's a liquid market, assuming that a liquid market develops around these tokens.
Yeah.
Then, you know, why if you got $50,000 or $100,000 in your checking or savings account, why not throw it in some real estate? And if you can get it out tomorrow, you know, earn more than you could on, you know, a CD or whatever in your bank account. Mm. So that's the idea. So the real question is, because this liquidity will be, assuming liquidity will actually be there, are people willing to pay more for real estate assets than they would otherwise? And so then can you use this as this tokenization as a tool to actually go buy real estate and increase the value of the real estate?
Because it's so liquid.
Because it's so liquid. You know, in real estate, you can buy a REIT stock, which owns a basket of real estate, but that's not a specific building. Yeah. That is liquid.
And for the most part, anytime you transfer real estate, you're paying 3% on both sides or whatever. It's more, probably different for commercial real estate. Yeah. But you're paying some significant percentage of the overall valuation. Plus, you have lawyers involved. You have agents involved. Sure. All these other things. It's not buying and selling like you would on a stock market.
Right.
Or a crypto exchange.
Right. So this summer will be interesting to see how Harbor does with those assets.
I'd love to see some launch and just see how that market develops. Unfortunately, though, the access to those markets is going to be limited, right?
Mm-hmm. I think you would need to be accredited to fill. Although I don't know that for sure, but I'm pretty.
Now we've seen there's been two announcements recently around that. One was I think one of Polymath's investment or whatever you call it. Their announcements was that they've got some partnership with I think the Barbados Stock Exchange to try to offer their tokens on an active exchange. And then they bought tokens.com to be like a coin market cap for.
What do you think they paid for that?
Tokens. I know a decent amount about the domain landscape, and it depends if someone knew who was the buyer.
Okay.
If they knew that it was a fancy token within the crypto ecosystem, they would have charged a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised if they paid $1 million for something, up to $1 million for something like that. But probably,
I bet it was more.
Definitely six figures, okay. But I would say 250 to $1 million.
Okay.
That's my guess. And then the other announcement was T0 has a partnership, I think, with the Boston.
Yeah, Box.
Box. Okay. So that's the Boston Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. And that's to enable the similar trading of security tokens.
Yep.
But T0 itself isn't launched yet, right?
I don't know how that's going to work.
Okay.
But what's going to happen, though, is, okay, so let's assume securitization of assets happens and just say it's real estate. Think about how many buildings there are in the United States.
Yeah.
Then you're going to have millions of tokens. So how do you see through that amount of tokens to actually figure it out? And ask that question to the guys at Harbor, and what they said was, well, then there's going to be people who are going to set up their own exchanges that specialize in a slice of real estate. So it might be, hey, if you're interested in, you know, buying
islands
or class A office buildings in coastal cities.
That's a lot more practical than islands.
Yes. Okay, all right. Let's say you want to buy islands. So we're going to have an exchange that sells islands. And so you and I will create that exchange. We'll market to it. So we'll appeal to that slice of life that likes that. And so then what you're going to have is a lot of exchanges cropping up, hyping whatever their slice is.
And part of the deal is that creating these securitized pieces of whatever, let's say real estate, is simple. I know at least Polymath is like, you can do this in minutes, and you know, I can turn whatever I want into a security that becomes tradable.
That's right. And so with Polymath, what they're doing is they're creating a token, an ERC-20 token. It's not ERC.
Yeah, it's their own network. It's their own protocol.
ERC-7 something.
STO or something like that.
Yeah, where it will follow the rules of wherever it's being traded.
Okay.
So you might have different rules in different states as to who can invest in these things. And so the token will know that. It'll be a smart token, and it won't let itself be sold to a non-accredited investor or someone else who can't legally buy the token.
Mm.
And that's what they're creating.
That sounds like a lot of work to be able to, ST20 token is what they're calling it. Are you bullish on security tokens?
I am.
Do you see, other than something like Polymath, Harbor doesn't have one, Polymath, T0, are there really any other ways to get exposure to
and I have that is a question I have not figured out. I still don't have a clear.
I know. In disclosure, you're a little bit skeptical of Polymath's route, right? Which I think is fine. We can.
I don't know that I'm skeptical. You know how you just get a read on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a feeling.
Okay, so you're not sure they can deliver.
No, I'm not saying they can't deliver. I don't know.
You're staying away from it for now.
I actually own some.
Oh, you do?
I do. But I just. Yeah, I mean, I just get a feeling about some of the people on the team.
Okay.
I don't like the way it feels. Just leave it at that.
All right.
Which means, you know, nothing. That's just my own radar.
Yeah. No, that's fine. That's a reasonable reason to be skeptical, I think. But otherwise, you don't see a lot of ways to get exposure.
I don't know how to yet. I still don't see the whole process. I need to understand it a lot better than I do.
For me, that's my biggest reason for not even caring about much of the Polymath project itself, is like, if it's really the only route to be exposed to this entire ecosystem, then that makes me pretty bullish on it.
It's not the only route.
Well,
that's for sure.
The only route to gain exposure for a layman.
Okay. Like
for someone that just says, this whole security tokens thing's a big deal, how do I do this? Polymath and T0 is not tradable yet, to my knowledge.
It's not.
So right now, Polymath is the only way to do it. So I'm like, well, I want some of that.
That makes sense. It's kind of like, if you want to have exposure to space, what options do you have? Really, it's only Poly, so invest there.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's my reasoning. But what other big like takeaways or segments of the market did you have interest in from Consensus? Or was it literally everything you can possibly think of pitched on the blockchain?
I mean, yeah, it was everything. I'm thinking, I mean, I'm still a big fan of stablecoins.
Oh yeah, let's talk about that a bit. And I think we're going to do another whole episode on stablecoins in the near future, I hope. But we now have, I think, two interviews, one that's out and one that's on the way out with stablecoins. Mm-hmm. Hopefully some more down the road where we'll talk to them.
For sure.
There's this whole fascinating debate about whether a stablecoin that really works could even kill the whole promise of what Bitcoin is supposed to provide. Mm-hmm. To the idea that stablecoins are close to being a total fraud, and like you can't possibly create a non-collateralized stablecoin, for example. Like Basis is the big one they're going at it from the route of being non-collateralized. I think the ones with lower goals are like the fully collateralized, so like a dollar for dollar type of stable token. We've seen one that was listed on Binance, and then they stopped it, and then they put it back because it couldn't peg the dollar because of the demand, which was
true USD.
Yeah, that was true USD, and that was a perfectly rational example of like why.
Well,
that's not very scalable.
Well, you had, I mean, and I think you had bots trading true USD, which weren't smart enough to understand that
it shouldn't.
It's a stable coin.
Yeah, you don't.
It's supposed to be $1.
You don't buy it.
That's when right.
It costs $1.05.
That's right. But their problem was that you know that what true you so you have Tether, which supposedly is backed dollar for dollar, you know, in checking accounts around the world.
And really, a lot of the market has come from the fact that, well, Tether's not going to be good enough for this market. This is a bigger market than just Tether.
Well, it's that people seem to not like it or trust it.
Right.
And you know, there's a whole thing this week with what's the exchange that Tether came from?
Bitfinex.
Bitfinex. you know, what's happening there. And, you know, could Tether just completely go away at some point? I think those that had kind of died down. I think you hear more of that this week.
Does TrueUSD have a share style token? So if you listen to Haven's interview and like a lot of these, they have dual tokens.
Yeah. So Tether right now. Yeah,
Tether is just just Tether.
Tether is just Tether, but the people who earn. Okay, so whenever you trade Tether, I think there's like a 15 basis point fee that you pay.
Okay.
Essentially, and so then that goes to whoever owns Tether.
So someone for the privilege of going to Tether and removing volatility from your portfolio. You're paying a small fee
to
the people that back Tether.
People that back Tether. Okay, so TrueUSD is similar. We cannot invest in TrueUSD unless you know whoever the owners of that are. And so TrueUSD has said, look, we will... Tether's not audited.
I'm looking at the TrueUSD chart, and it's an interesting amount of volatility for a stablecoin.
That's Bitcoin.
Yeah, I know.
That would be Bitcoin. But... So TrueUSD said, you know, we will let you guys, we'll provide audited proof that we are fully dollar to dollar backed. And so then that's one idea for stablecoin. Another idea is that it's asset backed, that may not be backed by dollars, but it could be backed by Ethereum, et cetera. That's the MakerDAO, the MakerDAI program. And then to some degree, that's Haven as well. And
so fully collateralized. By dollars, fully collateralized by other assets, so, like crypto, partially collateralized or non-collateralized.
And then non-collateralized would be seniorage shares, which is the idea that you can essentially use an algorithm to increase the number of stable coins to peg a dollar.
So when algorithmic inflation and deflation.
That's exactly right. And the inflation is easy. Anybody can do that. Deflation part is hard. And the way that the seniority shares like basis tries to do it is they create a bond token that says, okay, if you will if you'll pay 96 cents, we'll take a stable coin off the market, and then at some point in the future we'll give you that token for dollars. You've made 4 cents, and so then the price of the bond continues to decrease until enough people are willing to do that.
But you have to have participants that are willing to buy those bonds.
That's exactly right.
And
then what Basis is doing is they've raised $133 million, which will be their own liquidity pool to actually do that in addition to market makers.
Okay.
So they'll use their war chest to do that. The question is, can it work long term?
Yeah.
And that's the big argument that's raging, because if a senior share model can work long term, then essentially you get a free lunch.
Yeah.
You don't have to back it with assets. And you can just continue to do this, which is really what the US Reserve, Federal Reserve has done, right? They add money to the money supply and they take it away.
Yeah.
And instead of pegging to a dollar.
Yeah, since we're not gold backed.
That's right. They're not pegging to a dollar, they're pegging to, you know, certain goals that they have with, you know, full employment, et cetera.
The difference being that you have the full power of the United States government saying that a dollar is a dollar.
That's exactly right.
Whereas with this, you're trying to trust that same concept to algorithms designed by tech startups founded by 20-somethings.
From Princeton, who are really smart.
No, I'm not saying it's impossible.
Yeah.
The way I've approached it is the non-collateralized is the holy grail. Because you don't have to have all this collateral. And if it's truly going to scale in the sense of the network can be worth billions or hundreds of billions
of
dollars. All the money. Like, if that's going to be the case, then if you can reach the holy grail, then that's great. But it's obviously the most risky.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those, like, home run type plays if you have the share tokens. I do think it's fascinating that there's this realm of stable coins where you can have exposure to them, so that if you have the share tokens or the bond tokens, like however the different ones are, or they run, you can have exposure to their success based on the value of the share token, which I think is fascinating for
That's
people
right.
that are bullish on crypto in general and think that a stable coin is important.
Well, you have to. I mean, to trade, you need some ability to sit in a timeout share.
Yeah.
Preserve your capital.
Well, and for what you would call like the unit of account. So like, let's tie this back together. I'm going to want to know in a second how much people were talking about stable coins while you were there.
Okay.
But let's take the example of, here's your security token where real estate's involved. Well, there may be a transaction of crypto as well, but it's not in Bitcoin. Like, because you want a proper unit of account that's pegged to the dollar or pegged to a basket of goods. Because I, for my slice of the Empire State Building, I only want to pay $100,000. So for my slice, $100,000, well, maybe it's 10 Bitcoin or maybe it's 12 or 15 or 5. But if I want to say $100,000, then a stablecoin could be another element of that ecosystem.
Would be much better. You'd be much better off to use
a stablecoin. You'd probably be worried with your real estate business to say, okay, well, give me, you know, whatever, 50
totally.
Bitcoin for this piece of real estate.
You'd need to immediately turn that to cash because that's not the game you're playing with that.
Right. You're adding a whole new dynamic to your business.
That's exactly right. Which is why I think the perfect cryptocurrency is actually a stablecoin.
Yeah. So for some point. Because of the need for unit of account.
Unit of account. And you then don't have the sense that it's going to grow in value. And so therefore you tend to not use it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a good...
Yeah. The whole debate, the whole critique of deflationary currency is that people are incentivized to not use it.
Well, I don't think it has to be... Yes, you're right. I don't think it has to be deflationary. I think if it just stays what it is, you're still going to use it to buy coffee. But if Bitcoin's, you know, on a tear and we're in a year-long bull market, you're going to use Bitcoin to go buy coffee.
I'm saying for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
One of the biggest reasons people that are bearish on Bitcoin as money is because its deflationary or anti-inflationary nature makes you unwilling to spend it, which I've found myself feeling that as well. So, like, the idea is that a progressive economy can't work on that. It needs a currency that's got...
It's kind of pushing you to use it.
Correct.
The whole time.
Correct. And which is the whole idea of having minimal inflation year to year, designing the system and a Federal Reserve and all this stuff. And I don't want to get too political.
Yeah, I was about to say, we've gone down so many rabbit holes.
I know. This is just kind of we're thinking about in crypto post-consensus.
Yeah.
That's what this chat's about. Let's pull back.
Okay.
So was there talk around stablecoins? Was it a theme of the conference, you think?
I would not say it was a theme.
Okay, yeah. So we're not there yet.
I mean, it's just an aspect. You know, it's a slice.
For now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they were all there. I mean, Haven was there when I interviewed the guys from Australia. You know, they're in the middle. They're the second. Haven is the second stablecoin to launch on Ethereum. Maker is the first. And they're going to be actually launching where it's really in production in June, where you can use their Namens, which is their stablecoin,
which would be the key component of growing their network and therefore increasing the value of the share tokens.
That's right. So Haven right now, the way they look at it is they say, okay, there's two tokens. There is the Haven token, which is HAV, and then there is the Namens token, which is right now it's I think it's e-Namens, that's not the final Namens that you're going to use to actually buy.
But either way, the Namens is the equivalent of the PEG token.
The Namens is the dollar PEG token, exactly. Yeah. And so the idea is that in the fall, you'll be able to use your HAV token and stake it and then create Namens from that. And then when those Namens are bought or sold, you earn the fees.
Hmm.
So the staked Haven earns the transaction fees. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to juice and add adoption and use of the Namens token. So one of the things they've done is they've created an e-store where actually right now today you can buy Apple products. And if then you're in the US, you can actually buy all Apple products, including the iPhone 10, are 20% off right now. So what you need to do is just go convert your Ethereum to their Namens and you can use that. And so what they're trying to do is to create and boost transaction fees, which then will grow their network.
And both of us should disclose we're exposed to several stable coins.
Yes.
So we're not, we are biased conversationalists.
Totally.
That we both at least see some potential monetary value in this ecosystem. So one of my big concerns about stable coins is that I can understand them as small goals. So like being used in this isn't that small, but a unit of account in a real estate transaction that's on the blockchain, you want a stablecoin to be associated with that. Totally get it for a use case like that. When people get into these conversations of like, oh, this is money, it's much harder for me to comprehend because in the end of the day, you have these shareholders that are responsible for this system, and there's so few. You know, like when you think of the people involved in crypto and these investors, right. It's like, okay, so now Andreessen Horowitz and you know, these other venture capital firms and then individual investors, like we're now the backers of money. That's, to me, that's absurd.
And but isn't that what Bitcoin is?
Yeah, and that's a reason why it's hard for me to understand Bitcoin as money either. Yeah. Like, I can understand Bitcoin as gold because gold's always been that way. It's been in the hands of few, like physical gold.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard for me to think of it in that way for money.
Yeah, I don't even go there with calling it money, as in like money that I'm going to use when we go eat Mexican for lunch today. I think of it, you know, Jack Dorsey had a quote. I thought it was the quote of the conference, and it was, the web deserves a native currency.
The internet deserves a native currency.
Will have a native currency that is fully used and utilized on the web. You know, to use a dollar, you have to go through intermediaries, as we all know. So the web doesn't have its own money yet, and it will.
The exact quote was, the internet deserves a native currency. It will have a native currency. I don't know if it'll be Bitcoin. But he did say,
He said, I hope it will be. All right, so if you believe that premise, and I do, I firmly
agree with that as well. We're all on board there.
The internet will have its own money. Okay. Then what's it going to be? You know, is it going to be, Bitcoin that grows in value and shrinks in value? Or is it going to be something that's more stable, that, you know, that keeps its value and does its unit of account, as you said? I can totally see a stable currency achieving that and being the thing you use online.
And I agree with that. And that's also what makes me lean towards a non-collateralized or a partially collateralized stable currency. Because, for example, the whole like Binance delists true USD thing, the reason that their peg was so bad is because they're limited based on making ACH transfers to and from banks.
Totally.
Which to me is nonsense. It's like, this is not what you want a stable coin to be to me. Mm-hmm. Like, you're still completely relying on banks. This is not an internet run.
It's like a dollar that's wrapped in ETH or something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't know. Yeah, it's like it doesn't fit to me.
Right.
It's still basically a dollar, but in internet form, and still relies on traditional infrastructure like, you know, banks and ACH. And they have fees, they have hours, they have downtime, they're centralized. There's all these things that make that not great for me. So when I approach this ecosystem, like, I'm willing to make the bigger bets on the ones that are collateralized by crypto, partially collateralized by crypto, or non-collateralized. Those are the ones that are interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I just have, and I know that all of these projects, they have to have this like grand vision of like, maybe we can be money someday. I'm not that bullish.
Okay.
But I want to continue that conversation. We dug a little more into stablecoins than I expected, but I think it's a conversation we're going to have for several years.
Yeah, and I'll put a final sort of period on it. I think the reason there's so much interest in it is that it is the biggest prize in crypto. There's no other total addressable market that's bigger than money. And so that's why you're going to see so much interest. And so whether it works long...
We'll see the most dramatic failure there too.
Sure. But whether it works long term, I don't know. But I think that's absolutely a place to invest, because short term, people will come around to that. You might have Tether fail at some point, and then what's going to happen to all the stable currencies?
But Tether's pretty small, or even it's dominant but small.
Correct.
Yeah.
But you may have that fail, and if that fails, then you know people you have to trade with some sort of stable, and the demand's going to be there for the other stable currencies that are there.
Cool. Well, let's wrap up with I want to get Jack Dorsey's was the talk of the talk of the event.
So yeah, it was the keynote.
Did you have a takeaway from what he said?
I was really impressed with him and how they run their companies.
Talked about Square. He didn't talk about Twitter, despite everyone on crypto Twitter wanting him to address all the scammers on crypto Twitter.
Yeah, I just think it's a big problem. If you listen to him, you would know that he doesn't like what's happening with Twitter. But I think it's just a big problem that's hard to solve.
Yeah. But from the Square perspective, you said you were impressed with the way he's addressing crypto from Square.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he clearly loves it. I think his initial problem when they first did it was that there just wasn't much demand.
Yeah, he seems like he was on board way earlier than most people Probably most people in the space generally, but certainly within his company.
Was totally.
Like, it seems like he was kind of driving the initiative internally within.
And he said that there was a lot of strife within the company, even on this big decision of doing it.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who didn't like it. But I think, maybe the answer comes with Lightning Labs, which he's invested in, which is why they were on the...
He even hinted, like, this is why we're working with you. He said that to, what's her name? She's the CEO of Lightning Labs that interviewed him.
We need to have names.
Yeah, we're terrible better. At this.
We need to have our crypto names with cards.
Anyway, so he said, this is why we're working with you. And they didn't really go anywhere beyond that.
What he meant was he's an investor in Lightning Labs.
Sure, but like,
yeah,
that's a big deal. Anyway, so.
Well, I mean, because obviously that can solve a lot of the problems. And, we don't have to go into what Lightning is. I think most people know.
I think it'll be a big deal, though, if beyond Square Cash. Like, Square Cash is just an app that people really don't use that much. It's growing faster than Venmo, but I'd say Venmo is way ahead in terms of global usage. But you can just buy or sell Bitcoin in cash. I think where it gets really interesting, the role Jack Dorsey and his company can have, is if you bring it to whatever the 2 million plus merchants on Square. Like, everywhere you go, almost, like, all the small shops and stuff, they have Square. So, like, if you can...
Mm-hmm.
accept Bitcoin on a Square terminal, like, that's really interesting to me.
Right, which would be the Lightning Network.
Yeah.
To enable that.
Yeah.
And you would incorporate that with it.
But in that instance, I could see people keeping, like, a portion of their liquid cash, savings, whatever, in Bitcoin, because they're like, this is almost like an interest-earning checking account, which you don't get anymore in real life. So now if I can pay for stuff and whatever else and be earning interest by owning Bitcoin... behind that, to me, that's a really interesting real scenario of crypto.
Yeah. The other thing is the kids these days is that, younger people aren't opening checking accounts, and that's a problem for banks. And
Elizabeth Stark, by the way, is Lightning Labs.
Yeah, Elizabeth Stark. She's got such a great name.
It is a good name.
What she does.
Starkness.
Stark. Lightning. But kids are not opening bank accounts, and so Venmo, they have Venmo instead of bank accounts, things like that. So I think that it may take time for adoption, but I think that the generation below us are totally ready to to use a stablecoin as their currency.
To me, the killer crypto app is something that's as good, works as well, and the interface is as good, the social components are as good as something like Venmo,
yeah,
but is crypto-backed. And why not? Because then it's all your money. Like, if I have a balance on Venmo, like, that's PayPal that has my money in their centralized system, and they can make all sorts of decisions that I don't like, including shutting down my account or whatever else. So to me, that's the killer crypto app that amazes me that we don't have yet, although I know there's some that are working on
it. Oh, yeah.
But I'd like to see that, so. Cool.
Very good.
This is our...
Get some...
Random conversation, but I think hopefully encompasses a bit of your takeaways from Consensus and what we're thinking about the market. We didn't dig too much into price action. We'll do that on another episode. There's some interesting stuff going on right now with EOS launching and a bunch of other stuff, and we'll see if Bitcoin makes a lower low or a higher low. Hopefully the market will survive for us, because
I don't want to look.
Need to feed my family and all that good stuff. All right, man. It's good talking to you, and we'll catch y'all next time.
Okay. Bye-bye. Monuments crumble.